grandma worried Christmas Eve in 1943. Worried that my great-grandpa would be sent to Germany. Would Christmas ever be the same if he had to go? Would this be his last Christmas? They had no way to know. My granddad was just 21 when he went to Vietnam. Sent to Asia, into war, leaving grandma and my mom. Would Christmas ever be the same? They had no way to know. Christmas Eve, Mom made a wish so many years ago. Dear Santa, put peace in my stocking. Fill it to the top with love and cheer. If everyone had peace in their stocking, then it would feel like Christmas every day of the year. Daddy, can you tell me what is an enemy? And what's this place called Palestine I've heard of on TV? Does Santa visit children there on Christmas every year? If he does, I hope that he'll have a wish that he will hear. Dear Santa, put peace in their stockings. Fill them to the top with love and cheer. If everyone had peace in their stockings, then it would feel like Christmas every day of the year. If everyone had peace in their stockings, that peace would fill our hearts with love and cheer. And each day when we pull on our stockings, we would fill our socks with peace every day of the year. Because our socks would fill our shoes, and our shoes filled with our feet would carry us to spread that peace to everyone we meet. So fill those Christmas stockings with peace, love, and cheer. Then put them on and wear them every day of the year. Please put them on and wear them every day of the year.
That song's called Put Peace in My Stocking. It's one that I wrote several years ago. Always hoping that that song will sometime become obsolete. Unfortunately, that day hasn't come yet. Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Community Church of Hendricks County. I'm Sam Carman, on the board of directors here. We are a progressive congregation consisting of people of many beliefs, some with a religious background, some without, some who believe in a God, some who don't. Our beliefs are diverse but inclusive. We have no shared creed, but instead a shared covenant, including our seven principles, which you'll find posted on the wall behind, beneath the clock. Whatever your faith, whomever you love, we welcome you with all of your truths and your doubts, your worries and your hopes. We are a community that embraces freedom of thought, where people come together to encourage each other to spiritual growth that makes for peace, ethical living, and community service. During these Chautauqua sessions, a collection plate will not be passed, but donations are graciously accepted. Donation plates are located at the back table, and then there's one on the overflow on the table in the overflow room. If you have any questions about our church, feel free to explore the literature that you'll find on the tables, and you can also speak with any of us who have a name tag. And now I'd like to turn things over to Bill Harrington, who will be our moderator this evening.
Thank you, Sam. I feel bad that I'm wearing sandals tonight because I don't have socks on. But I see a baby in the room, and I hope that baby always hears words about peace. I did want to offer a kind thought to Phil Gully and his family. Phil's dad passed recently, and that's why he's not with us here this evening. He'd been quite ill. I found myself reflecting as I was driving into Danville this evening about, you know, why the Chautauqua happened. You know, what inspired Phil and Sam to want to get us together on a regular basis. And obviously, I think we all must confess that in our lifetimes, the sense of incivility in our world right now is reaching some all-time highs. And I find myself every Sunday evening as I'm trying to have a little moment of meditation about the week that's coming, I'm looking at my calendar and I'm planning for the week ahead, just some hope that maybe this week will be better. You know, and I've gotten to the point, and I think we all have, where you say to yourself, well, surely to goodness it couldn't get any worse than it was last week. And I think part of that is the blessing of the timing of when we were born. You know, we've had so much relative peace in America, in the sense that we don't have battles on our homeland. We conduct plenty of wars elsewhere, obviously. We kill people someplace else. But the sense of peace here has been pretty pervasive in our lifetimes. But now we have these words that are used, that are dividing words. And there must be young children, and we don't have any left in the home. We have a grandson, 20 months old, and he's talking a lot. I don't know how long it's going to be before he understands what's being said on TV and asks what lots of children must be asking now, which is, why do these politicians say these things? I thought leaders were supposed to unite us and make us feel better about the world we're living in. So that was the whole purpose of the Chautauqua, is to at least get together and talk and see if we could reframe our thought processes about how we might spread the notion among family and friends of focusing on our common denominators. Something that maybe we didn't have to do before, because they weren't hidden. They were real. They were just part of our day-to-day lives. We got along. We didn't say hateful things about each other as much. And I find myself on social media sometimes still pushing the button when I know I shouldn't, because I say things because I feel things. And Betty, my wife, is so much better than I am about that time out. And so I'm trying to be better about that in the spirit of our Chautauqua. So, if we want to talk about incivility in our times, it only makes sense that we should grapple the issue of Israel and Palestine. Why not? And so Malka Bird is going to talk to us tonight. And I want to tell you a little bit about Malka before she gets started. I warned her that by virtue of the internet, I was able to find a lot of information about her. I ran it all through a filter, and I only left the really good stuff because I didn't want to be unkind. Malka Bird is a kindergarten teacher, a parenting coach, and a community organizer in Indianapolis. She attended Smith College and the University of Pittsburgh and is a licensed special education teacher. Malka has been working in play-based settings with young children and their families for more than 15 years. Through her teaching practice and her parenting of two young children, Malka has come to value the importance of curiosity, exploration, and creativity in educational settings. She currently teaches at Meridian Hills Cooperative Nursery School and Kindergarten, where she helped to develop a child-led, inquiry-based kindergarten program for 5- and 6-year-olds. Malka also serves and works for the American Friends Service Committee and is one of the chapter leaders, or perhaps the chapter leader, she'll let us know here in a minute, of the Indiana chapter of Jewish Voice for Peace. She has a deep commitment to anti-racist work here in Indianapolis, in the United States, and in Palestine and Israel. Malka is inspired by the long history of Jewish tradition and activism to work and organize within her community to help build peace, justice, and equality. Words that everyone in this congregation is familiar with hearing on a weekly basis. Originally from Detroit, Malka and her family moved to Indianapolis roughly 7 years ago. And this evening, Malka is going to speak on the topic of not a conflict against anti-Semitism and for Palestinian rights. Please join me in welcoming Malka Bird.
Okay. Am I doing the microphone right? I got it. Okay. Thank you for the tip. Good evening, everybody. Thank you so much for having me here tonight. This is such an honor. I saw the names of the other speakers that have been in this series, and it's quite a distinguished group, so I really appreciate being included here. And I love that this is something that you all are doing. What a really special way to start the week and to spend some time, or close the week, however this works for you, and spend time together with this. Like the introduction really covered my own introduction. But again, I'm Malka Bird. I'm a kindergarten teacher. I'm a mom. I'm an activist and a community organizer in Indianapolis. And I work primarily with two different organizations, Jewish Voice for Peace and the American Friends Service Committee. Both organizations are anti-racist, and they're working to combat anti-Semitism and Islamophobia here in the US and seeking to end the Israeli occupation of Palestine. So, for the most part, growing up Jewish in the U.S., which I did outside of Detroit, means growing up with a belief that Israel is the rightful homeland, which should be celebrated and defended as the national Jewish state. And this is a concept known as Zionism. These beliefs are subtle and overt. Israeli flags hang in most synagogues. Friends travel to Jerusalem for bat and bar mitzvahs. Am I too close? Summer programs tour Israel during college, and we raise money to plant trees in the desert. And critically, we're taught that safety, that the only path, in a world that's hostile to Jews, that the real only path towards safety and security was the existence of a Jewish state in Israel, a country that was founded by refugees. It was a land without a people for a people without a land, and its existence meant that there would never be another Holocaust. While I was definitely raised with this Zionist narrative, there was another deeply important aspect to my family's Judaism. I remember when I was young asking my mom what it meant to be Jewish, and she said confidently, I was sort of surprised how ready she was with an answer, but she said, "Oh, Jews are the chosen people." And I said, "Chosen to do what?" And she said, "Chosen to be Democrats." So now that I'm a bit older and I know more, a little bit more about Judaism and about Democrats, I've come to understand this idea in a slightly different way. For us, for my family, for many Jews, our religion is synonymous with our action. For many Jews, Judaism is not a religion about faith, it's a religion about goodness about ethics and actions, about fulfilling mitzvot or good deeds and or commandments. It's about tikkun olam, which is the concept of doing our best to see the suffering and the brokenness in the world and finding ways to alleviate or to repair it. So when my daughter was younger and started asking a lot of questions about God and Judaism, to which my husband and I were woefully unprepared, there was some confusion in our multi-faith family. One time she said, "I'm so glad that Dad is a Buddhist so that we still get to celebrate Christmas." I thought, man, we're doing a terrible job explaining all of this to you. I realized that I needed some help explaining this to her and getting her to understand this, and I started looking for Jewish communities and Jewish institutions that held those same beliefs, the centers of social justice and activism where she could experience being Jewish in the same way that I understood it. But what I found was that no matter where I looked, Israel continued to be front and center in every Jewish communal space. Around this time, it was about 2014, Israel had begun a war on Gaza, which is a small strip of Palestinian land that's stuck between Israel, Egypt, and the Mediterranean Sea. During this war, over 2,100 Palestinians were killed, 500 of whom were children. So because of my child, I went searching for Judaism, and instead, I could only find Israel, which at the time was killing children. This began the journey that I am still on today. In the Palestinian Solidarity Movement, I have found a deeper connection to Judaism and a more authentic, meaningful Judaism where actions and ethics are paramount than anything I would ever have imagined I could forge. I realized that I had a lot of learning to do and unlearning. As you may know, this might be one of the most controversial topics for an American Jewish person to explore. Here's some of what I learned. Jews began settling in Palestine well before World War II, but the Holocaust and the war sped up my immigration. As a result of this and other efforts, the State of Israel was created and recognized by the UN and the US. After that began a war of Israel independence in 1948. Because Palestine was not actually a land without a people, this war resulted in over 700,000 indigenous Palestinian men, women, and children being forced off their land, out of their homes, and into refugee camps, where many still reside today, 70 years later. This is called the Nakba, or catastrophe in Arabic. And since 1967, the West Bank has been under continuous, brutal military occupation that profoundly impacts every aspect of daily life, as was Gaza until 2005. Now all of the borders of Gaza are sealed. Since the blockade began, there have been two major wars on Gaza in 2008 and 9 and in 2014. Today, Israel's human rights violations and state violence against Palestinians is escalating. The list of daily atrocities faced by Palestinians in Gaza, the West Bank, and Israel are innumerable. 70 plus years of settler colonialism has taken a harsh toll on communities, the economy, families, and children as people struggle to survive under a militaristic regime that includes restriction of movement through apartheid walls and checkpoints, dispossession through village demolitions and home and property seizures, food and water insecurity, and threats to safety from seemingly unchecked violence carried out by the Israeli Defense Force. These events, this history, was vastly different than the one that I had learned as a child. My eyes were open to this devastating reality and to the myths that I had learned in my institutional Jewish experiences. I felt deeply disconnected and even betrayed. You never told me. However, at the same time, I was incredibly fortunate to find a large and vibrant community of Jews, non-Jews, Muslims, Christians, Quakers, Americans, Israelis, and Palestinians who were working for justice and equality, actively combating anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, and racism. As part of that work, I've had the opportunity to speak to different audiences on this topic. And for tonight, I had been planning on giving a talk that I've given before, a discussion of Judaism and anti-Semitism, Palestine and Zionism. It's a good talk, if I do say so myself. It's interesting material, it's relevant, political. And over the past couple weeks, I started to prepare updating content, reviewing slides. And then the President of the United States of America began attacking four US Congresswomen of color on Twitter. And I'm not a millennial, so I have no attachment to Twitter. I don't understand it, I don't get it, but apparently he does. He told them to go home. He accused them of being un-American, of hating our country, and then he accused them of anti-Semitism, repeatedly. He's still doing it, and he'll continue. And so I realized that tonight we needed to do some unpacking, to talk together to figure out how we got here. There is no question that we're seeing a visible rise in anti-Semitism. On August 11th, 2017, white nationalists and neo-Nazis marched in the streets of Charlottesville, Virginia, chanting, "Jews will not replace us," at a Unite the Right gathering, famously referred to as having good people on both sides. On July 28, 2018, a synagogue here in Indianapolis was vandalized with swastikas and Nazi symbolism. And most tragically, on October 27, 2018, 11 Jews were murdered while praying in a synagogue in Pittsburgh. Another murderer entered a synagogue in Poway, in California, on April 27th of this year, killing one and injuring three. What we now know is that in all of these instances, the perpetrators were not just anti-Semitic, they were also anti-refugee and anti-Muslim. And all of it, yes, even the anti-Semitism, is born of white supremacy. So what's happening here? In order to understand the current climate, the increase in anti-Semitic incidents, the increase in accusations of anti-Semitism, and critically, in this moment, the logic that is being used by Trump that leads to his Twitter attacks, we have to begin to differentiate between anti-Semitism and false accusations of anti-Semitism. And to do this, we have to understand the connection between Zionism and white supremacy. So to help us do that, we need only to turn to the words of Richard Spencer, a leader in the alt-right movement and one of the architects of the Charlottesville demonstration. On August 6, 2017, less than a week after the Unite the Right rally, Richard Spencer was interviewed on Israeli Channel 2. When asked about the anti-Semitic sentiments expressed at the rally, he said, "You could say that I am a white Zionist in the sense that I care about my people. I want us to have a secure homeland for us and ourselves, just like you want a secure homeland in Israel." A few months later, on October 19th of that year, he spoke at the University of Florida and said, "The most important and perhaps most revolutionary ethno-state, and it's one that I turn to for guidance, even though I might not always agree with its foreign policy decisions, is the Jewish state of Israel." After a rabbi at Texas A&M struggled to confront Richard Spencer, Jewish activist Max Blumenthal said, "Zionists are poorly positioned to confront nationalists." And why is this? It's because Zionism at its core, and certainly in its current iteration, is a form of white supremacy. As Richard Spencer points out, it is a preferencing, a bias, a privileging of Jewishness, and specifically white Jewishness. It is a set of rights and freedoms and justice for one group at the significant expense of another. Look, Israel is a country. It has a government, courts, military. It is also the number one recipient of US foreign aid at $3.8 billion annually through 2026. American Jews and others are told that we're not supposed to criticize Israel, and certainly not out loud. But let me be clear. Not only is it okay to be critical of Israel, but it is required of us. As Americans, through our tax dollars, our lobbying, and our general pro-Zionist sentiment, or our silence, we perpetuate the ongoing and brutal military occupation of Palestine, and the dispossession and displacement of millions of Palestinians. Our government blocks every attempt made at the United Nations to hold Israel to account. And as Jews, we are commanded to speak out against injustice, especially when it's being done in our name. So, this brings us to the Squad. Why them and why now? Have you heard of the Squad? Have you heard this reference? Okay, good. The Squad refers to Congresswomen Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and Ayanna Pressley. They are four women of color elected to Congress as Democrats in 2018. Ilhan Omar came to the States, to the U.S., as a refugee from Somalia. Rashida Tlaib is a Palestinian-American whose family lost their home during the Nakba. From the start, these women were under intense scrutiny. Omar and Tlaib were both on record criticizing Israel and its treatment of Palestinians. Both openly support the boycott, the Palestinian call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, or the BDS movement, which is a nonviolent, constitutionally protected form of protest against the Israeli occupation. The criticism of these women is not only coming from the right, though it is certainly rampant there. There have also been countless attacks within the Democratic Party from liberal and not so liberal mainstream Jewish organizations, including the ADL, Jewish federations, and Jewish community relations councils. These attacks are part of a strategy, a weaponizing of anti-Semitism. Make no mistake, this is a tactic to drive a wedge amongst progressives, to defame activists, Palestinians who advocate for their own freedom and liberation, and others who speak out in solidarity. We have heard valid criticism of Israel described as criticism of Jews. We have witnessed the silencing of organizers and the demonization of Muslims and Arabs. The recent frenzy of these attacks led Rabbi Alyssa Wise to write a piece in Newsweek last week. She said, "The charge of anti-Semitism has long been used as a cudgel to stifle pro-Palestinian activism. It is now being used ingeniously to shield actual neo-Nazis, bona fide racists and their enablers from criticism. And all the while, real, murderous anti-Semitism is allowed to fester in the United States. It's truly, actively, urgently dangerous. The time to draw a line on what anti-Semitism is and what it isn't before Trump's incitement to violence last week turns deadly." And so here we are again. What is and what isn't anti-Semitism? And here's the easier answer. Anti-Semitism, the irrational prejudice against or hatred of Jews as Jews, has a long and toxic pedigree. And since the Holocaust, at the least, the accusation of anti-Semitism has had an extremely powerful sting and effect, as it should. Precisely because the history of anti-Semitism is so murderous, the false smear of anti-Semitism, weaponized against those who harbor no animus against Jews as Jews, but only seek justice for Palestinians, is so powerfully toxic. But here's what is not anti-Semitism. Criticism of Israeli policy is not. Neither is criticism of Zionism. Nor is being an anti-Zionist. Many, many Jews and others were and are anti-Zionists, for they felt they could be fully Jewish and fully American without a backup country in the Middle East. They don't think that having a so-called Jewish state makes Jews any safer or is fair to the people who lived there before. Make no mistake, we must, and we will, always speak out against the acts of hate directed towards Jews, large and small, every time. But just as important, we must also speak out against false accusations of anti-Semitism, large and small, every time. Anti-Semitism is real and can be quite terrifying. It is deeply connected to anti-Black, anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant, anti-queer, white supremacy. It's a product of nativism and xenophobia, of fascism and ethno-nationalism. Using false accusations of anti-Semitism as a Zionist tactic, this is also incredibly dangerous, particularly to activists of color whose lives can be ruined by these charges, but also to Jews whose true safety depends on solidarity and on a clear-eyed understanding of the greatest threats against our community. Leaders like Netanyahu and Trump spout xenophobic nationalism, and the response of too many mainstream Jewish organizations has been to close their eyes and cover their ears. Let the record be clear, this is how they missed it. They cried wolf again and again while they ignored the dog whistles of very real, very threatening anti-Semitism, which are now tornado sirens. The storm is, has been, and will be here. And there is a straight line from this president's words and policies to the recent vile acts of anti-Semitism. Hatred of Jews, people of color, Muslims, immigrants, and efforts to help immigrants fueled many of these attacks. And this administration is providing the gas. While rhetoric has certainly escalated, the targeting of these congresswomen is not a new tactic. Black and brown activists have been speaking out for justice in Palestine at great personal risk. Mark Lamont Hill, Angela Davis, Linda Sarsour, Tamika Mallory, Stephen Salida, and now Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. They are not speaking out because they are anti-Semitic, quite the opposite. They do so because they truly, deeply care about liberation, equality, and justice for all people. Universal freedom, universal values, no race or religion to take a back seat to any other. Black and brown, Jewish and Muslim, Israeli and Palestinian, it is for this reason that they take these risks, that they face being defamed, fired, targeted, harassed, and worse. Which brings me to the concept of civility and civil discourse, which is why we're here. In preparation for this evening, I listened to some recordings of the past talks, and a few weeks ago, Jim Mulholland read from Dr. King's letter from a Birmingham jail. While many of us are familiar with Dr. King's letter, fewer have read the words that inspired his response. A piece signed by 8 white clergymen, including a rabbi, calling for civility. The term used as a thinly veiled attempt to silence the civil rights protests that were occurring at the time. Thanks to Dr. King and many black activists who came after him, we now have a more nuanced understanding of this idea of civility as one effort to tone police, to silence, and to discredit black and brown activists. We acknowledge that we have allowed whiteness and white supremacy to define the idea of civility, and that anything out that falls outside of this narrow definition does not meet our standard of discourse. And yet, for many reasons, this more nuanced understanding has not extended itself to the conversation around human rights in Palestine. Muslim, Arab, and other activists of color are scrutinized, defamed, threatened, and silenced in the name of civility under the guise of speaking out against anti-Semitism. There is complexity in this discussion for sure, but we can and we will move towards true justice. This is not a conflict. One can stand against anti-Semitism and for Palestinian rights. In order to do this, we have to commit to a redefinition of civility. One that centralizes and uplifts the voices of the most marginalized, that accounts for the cruelty of and the dehumanization caused by white supremacy, that charges allies, those of us with great privilege, to participate in costly solidarity, to resist the path of least resistance. A definition of civility that keeps kids out of cages from US to Palestine, that requires us to call a Nazi and a concentration camp, a concentration camp. A fight for civility that demands we speak out even when it is difficult, especially when it is difficult. And ultimately, a charge to follow in the words of the Hebrew prophets, let us comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. Thank you. Condensed.
If you will,
we will bring the microphone around to anyone that would like to question or comment. Well, I'll start.
Great, thank you.
When Trump made his comments about the four women about going home, go back where he came from, based on other things that he has said, I can't help but wonder if he even makes a connection mentally with the issues that you're talking about, or just the fact that these are four women who have an opinion. So I guess my question, you'd referenced another talk that you do that really goes into defining the problem more thoroughly. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of us are probably in a situation where we don't have as many facts or we don't know as much about the background as we probably should. Mm-hmm. So is there a website that where you are on? Okay.
That's a great question. There's a lot to that question, and it's something we've been talking about a lot lately. So yes, first of all, there are many wonderful resources out there that talk about the Nakba, that present the issue about what happened in Palestine from a Palestinian perspective, or at least a more accurately historical perspective. The Institute for Middle East Understanding is a wonderful resource. AFSC, the American Friends Service Committee, has fantastic resources, particularly on Gaza and on the blockade in Gaza. And Jewish Voice for Peace also has full resources on this topic. So those are great places to start. Also, just finding Palestinians who are speaking out about their experiences is also, for me, was a very helpful way to learn this. But I think the other piece of this that's really important that everybody says, and I think is that it's complicated, right? When someone brings up Israel and Palestine, we have this line where we say, like, I don't know, it's complicated. It's too complicated for me to understand or to have an opinion on one way or the other. And it was certainly something that I said. And what I've come to realize is that this is really one of the only human rights injustice issues where we feel like we have to have a PhD in history and political science before we can take a stand on it. Yeah. You know, like this is, and that is a tactic too, right? That's a strategy to make us feel like if we don't come from a place of deep knowledge and understanding about this, we can't advocate for Palestinians because we don't know enough, because it's too complicated. And I really want to start to try to push back against that idea and say, you know, occupation is actually quite simple. It's not complicated. And the results of occupation are quite simple. Dispossession, displacement, genocide, ethnic cleansing. These are things that we can recognize, something that we can see that's happening in front of us. And so if we don't know every date of every declaration, of every treaty, of every Oslo Accord, that doesn't have to prevent us from saying, I'm looking at what's happening in Palestine today, and I know that this is not right. I see injustice and I see inhumanity, and something has to change about what's happening today. So while I absolutely encourage us to seek out resources, I think we don't have to wait to take a stand on this until we have our PhD in Middle East studies and like we're told we're supposed to. So I thank you for that question because I really think it's important.
Hi, thank you.
Yeah.
Do you have any idea what the percentage of Israelites favor a type of attitudes that you talk about versus the Netanyahu side?
Yeah, so Israel right now is about 80% Jewish and 20% non-Jewish. So there are Palestinian and Arab citizens of Israel, and currently they do not have, there's about 200 some laws that they, that are things that are available to Jewish Israelis that are not to Arab or non-Jewish Israelis. So right now in Israel, non-Jewish Israelis, as well as Palestinians who are living in the West Bank and Gaza, are subject to a different set of laws, which is the definition of apartheid. So they're living under apartheid. In Israel, the Jewish sentiment in Israel is predominantly Zionist. It's sort of, I have an Israeli friend who says it's just like living and breathing there. You know, it's not quite the same conversation that we're having here. Netanyahu, while he doesn't win the majority, the Zionist parties overwhelmingly win in elections and are able to seat a parliament. And the Arab and Palestinian and pro-peace groups don't do quite as well in the parliamentary election system that they have there. But also, like we see in America, it's the same tactics. There's voter suppression. Palestinians living in the West Bank and Gaza don't vote in Israeli elections, even though they're subject to Israeli laws and are tried and convicted in Israeli military courts. So I think, you know, if it was truly a one person, one vote situation, we may see something that looked more like a balancing out, but the way that it's playing out right now, there's strong support for these sort of farther right, increasingly further right sentiments that are growing in Israel. Thanks for that question.
Malka, one of the things you pointed out is that the Zionists have done such a good job of making it so that we can't even ask questions.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I ask a question about Israeli policy, I'm an anti-Semite.
That's right.
And therefore I'm shut down. Nobody's going to listen to me because I'm being anti-Semitic. But one of the things that I've found to be interesting is how is it that in 70 years now, since the creation of the State of Israel, that Israel is so in the forefront of American foreign policy. You pointed out the simple number game, the money. But no one's allowed to question what happens to Israel.
Yeah.
How is it that Israel became so powerful in American politics?
You know, I think it's a great question, and there's a lot of different components that go into it. One really important one is that we have the same origin story, right? So the U.S. was founded by religious refugees who were facing persecution, who came to the U.S. searching for freedom from persecution and colonized a land where indigenous population was and decimated the indigenous population. Well, that's Israel's origin story too. You had refugees, Jewish refugees, fleeing Europe, fleeing persecution, fleeing the Holocaust, who came to a land that was already settled by indigenous population, and the population became displaced and decimated. So there's something very fundamental about sharing that origin story, this white supremacist settler colonial origin story, that I think impacts that. I think after the Holocaust, an accusation of anti-Semitism, you know, so the world sort of took a breath and said, something terrible happened here. Obviously, we lost 11 million people in the Holocaust, and 6 million of whom were Jewish. And that sort of drove the conversation. Although I will say, at the time of the Holocaust, anti-Semitism was certainly the norm here in the U.S. We're well known for turning away ships of refugees fleeing Europe, sending them back to concentration camps. So I don't think it was that we were this enlightened place where we embraced the Jews and all of a sudden this was asked of us. I think there were some very strategic resource-based, settler colonial, white supremacy-based connections between the two. And to continue it, I mean, the Israeli lobby is very powerful. AIPAC is a powerful organization. Right in our own backyard at IU Bloomington, there are 13 pro-Zionist organizations on campus and zero pro-Palestinian organizations on campus. So there's a junior AIPAC, there's an Israel Campus Coalition, there's a college Zionism Zionist Organization of America on campus, and there is not one Palestinian advocacy organization. So it is spread far and wide and deep in our country right now.
I remember when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s, it was in an all-white public school, small school in the country. I don't think there were many Jews even in the church, in the school, mm-hmm. nor were there any blacks. And there was no talk about Arabs or Muslims, so as people grow out of that, it's all foreign to them. Yeah. And so they're the foreigners and not one of us.
Yeah.
And that's to relate it to, bring it up to current times, the 40% of the people that support Trump, the white working class so-called Christians, are afraid of the same loss of their identity by immigrants and people that aren't the same color as them getting more and more equal treatment. So it's the same thing as it is in Israel.
Absolutely. It's deeply, I mean, it you identify something that's so true, that anti-blackness and anti-Semitism and Islamophobia and anti-Muslim racism they're not three separate trees, right? These are branches off one tree. This is a place of nativism, of xenophobia, of insecurity about whiteness and white supremacy that is fed by rhetoric that places blame on immigrants. And this is not new, right? I mean, I think we can all think back to 9/11 and the rhetoric, what was happening for Muslims in our country around that time. And it didn't even begin with 9/11. It was, you know, there was already something in place that allowed us to invade Iraq and Afghanistan because of 9/11. There was already a well-seeded anti-Muslim sentiment happening in this country, which is deeply connected to anti-Semitism, to anti-blackness, as you're identifying.
You mentioned the similarities between the U.S. and Israeli history.
Uh-huh.
There's another aspect of that. Obviously, the Palestinians were ejected and persecuted by the Israelis, but many of the religious groups that were persecuted in Europe came to the United States and then persecuted the people who didn't agree with them here.
That's exactly right.
And somehow people who are persecuted don't learn that persecuting is not good.
Right. That's right. And I mean, I think there's a psychological trauma analysis that goes along with that. And I've heard stories, these really truly unbelievable stories about Jewish Mizrahi Jews who are Arab Jews, who when the State of Israel was formed, Arab Jews were, you know, there's lots of different versions of this, but Arab Jews came to Israel. So they had been living in Morocco, in Iran, in Iraq, sort of all over. There were Jews all over the region. And the first Jews that came to the area were not European Jews. There were Jews forever, you know, in the Arab world. And these Mizrahi Jews came from Morocco, they came from Iran. And when they came to Israel, to a country that was founded and settled by refugees who had left concentration camps, who's lost whole families and had lived through these concentration camps, they welcomed these Mizrahi Jews into their country by taking them into concentration camps and spraying them with DEET to kill lice and vermin that they said were living on them because they were brown Arabs coming into the country. So the same act, this trauma that had been enacted on them, so directly turned around and enacted on Jewish Arabs coming into their country. So the connections are so, you know, generational, they're big picture, they're individual, but it's really true that we can't escape this this cycle until we actively decide to end the cycle.
The lesson is there's nothing wrong with persecution as long as you're not the one being persecuted.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And it's also really interesting. We recently about some of these early Zionist propaganda posters, and they showed they're these pictures of these Israelis, and they were these big blonde men, and they would make these calendars. Actually, someone mentioned, a friend of mine who's in her 60s mentioned as a child she had these Zionist calendars in her kitchen as a child, and every picture was this like strapping blonde man in the pictures. Yeah. And they looked completely Aryan, you know? I mean, they were like sort of out of the Nazi handbook. And it was this idea that Israel was where like the real Jews were, where these like strong Jews, these powerful Jews. And if that's what it was like to be there, then we wouldn't be at risk again, right? We would be safe. The Holocaust could never happen again because we weren't these weak, you know, visions of Jews. Instead, we were these strong and powerful militaristic Jews. And I think it perpetuates today. I mean, there's trips where kids can go over to Israel and be in the IDF. And I saw a picture of Jerry Seinfeld firing some Israeli military weapon. And so this is something that this kind of vision of, you know, this stronger version of us exist in the motherland is very real and very powerful for people. Powerful imagery.
Like so many of the anglicized depictions of Jesus.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. Yeah. When people find out he was actually a Palestinian Jew, yeah. It's a surprise.
The recognition of Jerusalem being the capital,
yeah.
What's with that?
Yeah, that's a great question. Really good question. So Jerusalem is a multi-faith city, right? So it is one of the holiest sites for Jews, for Muslims, Al-Aqsa, which is that big golden dome that you see in all the pictures of Jerusalem. That's, you know, the second holiest site for Muslims, second to Mecca. And then obviously Christianity has strong ties to Jerusalem. So even in the partition discussions leading up to 1948, to the declaration of the State of Israel, Jerusalem was always considered to be this international multi-faith city. It was never going to belong to one group, one religion, one country or the other. It was always meant to be this city where Muslims, Jews, Christians had full access to it. And part of that was that Jordan, in these conversations, Jordan was going to oversee the city. And so it wasn't even going to necessarily be officially Israeli in certain capacities. About 20 or so years ago, the Jewish lobby, Israel itself, started pushing to have its capital moved to Jerusalem. And right now, the way that Jerusalem is divided up, if you look at a map, East Jerusalem is Palestinian. It's considered to be part of Palestine. The green line that divides, that was formed in 1967, which divides the West Bank from Israel, cuts right through Jerusalem. The apartheid wall, the separation wall that was built, cuts through Jerusalem. East Jerusalem's on one side, it's a Palestinian area, and West Jerusalem's a Jewish area. Palestine has always wanted East Jerusalem to be its capital. So the idea that if we ever do have a two-state solution, which is becoming increasingly, you know, obsolete as an option, is that Jerusalem would be, for the Palestinians, East Jerusalem would be their capital. It's where Al-Aqsa is. It's sort of the edge, the leading edge of the West Bank. And so about 30 years ago, Israel started pushing to have their capital move from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem and to have the embassies move from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. And every president actually, including Obama, promised to do it. That was part of their sort of discussion. It was like one of their campaign promises. And then when they became president, they kind of kicked the ball down the field and said, you know, this is a mess. I'm not going to get into this. And really, what's trying to occur is a complete annexation of Jerusalem. You know, an ultimate annexation where East Jerusalem becomes part of Israel that's taken from the West Bank. And we see it right now. Just last week, there were over 100 homes demolished. 1,000 Palestinians lost their homes in East Jerusalem because supposedly they were too close to the security fence, to the border that was put up, to the wall. So the annexation is happening. And this move of the capital to Jerusalem and of the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem gives credit, gives validity to this idea that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel and therefore cannot belong to the Palestinians. The Palestinians don't have claim to it. So what we see with Netanyahu, with the settlements, the increasing settlements that are happening in the West Bank, if you look at a map of the West Bank right now, you know, sort of show, when you look at a map of Israel, they sort of show Israel's the strip in the middle, and then on the west side, you see Gaza as this tiny sort of strip by the sea. And on the east side is the West Bank. And that is, if you look at a detailed map, you'll see that actually the settlements have divided it up so much so that the land that's actually Palestinian land is minimal and totally non-contiguous. So you can't, even if you're in the West Bank, you cannot drive from one part of the West Bank to another part of the West Bank without crossing through countless military checkpoints. And sometimes they close the military checkpoints for days on end without telling anyone why. So if you're down in the south of the West Bank and you need to get north, military checkpoints are closed for 12 days, you're not going anywhere. There's no way to get through from place to place. So because of the settlements, because of this annexation, because of trying to annex East Jerusalem, life is becoming increasingly difficult, if it was even possible, for the Palestinians who are currently living in Palestine, in the area that is considered to be Palestine.
The United States government obviously has policies and positions toward Israel, and the average American probably has no opinion because they don't know enough about it.
Yep.
Israel probably has policies and positions toward the United States. What, the guy on the street in Israel, what are their opinions about the United States? Do they associate us with the leadership in our government now, or do they still look at us as the good guys back from World War II?
So that's such an interesting question. One, they are very pro-Trump in Israel. They actually phone banked for him in the last election. They had phone banking stations all across the West Bank, settlements in the West Bank.
So it wasn't just Russia?
No, it was Israel too. And actually, there's real evidence that a lot of some of the worst hacking and the election issues were Israeli companies that were doing that. So the Russians got a lot more play and press on it, but there is a second story about Israeli pressure. They just named a town after him, actually, in the Golan Heights, which is a contested, occupied part of Syria that Israel occupies, called the Golan Heights, and they named a new settlement there, Trump Heights or something. There's, you know, his name is in the thing. They've got a big picture of him everywhere. So I think general sentiment towards Trump is really positive. I mean, he has seen the U.S. is viewed how our presidents are viewed to support, how much they support Israel. So Trump is a huge supporter, seen as a huge supporter of Israel. Therefore, it's very, very positive towards him. Obama was considered, he was called an anti-Semite. I mean, because he took what we would consider quite pro-Israeli, but in their opinion, not pro-Israeli enough, and the Iran deal, or the fact that he asked Netanyahu to stop building settlements, these things were seen as too much crossing the line into a pro-Palestinian narrative. As far as Jews, Israelis do not, many Israeli Jews, I can't speak for all, but there is a feeling that Jews living in the diaspora are not real Jews. That this idea that to be a real Jew, you had to have made Aliyah, to travel to Israel, to live there, and that's true Jewishness, and the rest of us are living partial Jewishness. And there are many, many secular Jews in Israel who are not increasingly the religious Jews, the more Orthodox, gained power there, and the rabbis from those groups are speaking out more comfortably and sort of expressing this idea that those of us who live outside of Israel are not, you know, not living the true Jewish calling, or that we're not real Jews. So I think right now they're a big fan of the states and what we're doing, and want to keep Trump or leaders like Trump in power as long as possible.
And if we had time tonight, we could talk about the whole Iran issue and how that's part of Zionist policy as well.
Yes, it's a whole nother thing, right? Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
Oh, one more.
Oh, two more. You hear justifications for the Israeli attacks on the Palestinians based on the Palestinian bombings and missiles.
Yep.
Can you give us a comparison in death and injury rates in Israel versus Palestine?
It's not, it's off the charts. It's not even comparable. I mean, thousands and thousands and thousands of Palestinians have died and have been injured, and Israeli deaths will, I mean, it's funny because they start this, and then, you know, I talk to a lot of Zionists, spend a lot of time talking to Zionists, and that's one of the arguments they make. You know, oh, well, rockets from Hamas, and it's just a defense. And then you sort of say, like, well, what's been the impact of the violence? And the numbers, you know, don't even touch. It'll be like seven Israelis to thousands and thousands of Palestinians. Gaza is literally 123 square miles that is bordered by a fence on three sides, and the Mediterranean Sea on another that is patrolled by Israeli boats. So they're totally locked down. All entrances in and out of Gaza are shut. The UN says that Gaza will be unlivable by 2020, which is something that we've been saying now for many years in this work. And then all of a sudden I had this thought, like, 2020 is in January, you know, like we've been saying 2020, like, oh, and there's 2.5 million people living in Gaza right now. They don't have clean drinking water. They have electricity 2 to 4 hours a day. People cannot get in. They can't get out. You can't get medical treatment. You can't. There, right now, there's a little girl. She just died of a brain tumor in an Israeli hospital, and they wouldn't let the rest of her family from Palestine travel to the hospital. So a six-year-old died alone because her parents were Gazan and living in Gaza. So the stories out of Gaza are truly horrifying. Hamas fires rockets into Israel, absolutely does. These rockets are, I think the last time the rockets got fired, there was three people injured from the rockets being fired. The response to these rockets are to shoot unarmed civilians at will at a border fence. Last week, 121 Gazans were shot by live fire standing at a border fence. Between unarmed, they don't have weapons in Gaza. Nobody can be armed. Nobody can be armed in Palestine, in the West Bank, or in Gaza. So, when you start to dig into those numbers, this threat of violence is not what is played out to be. I actually saw an IDF tweet that said, "Look out for the dangerous fire kites," and it showed a picture of Gazans trying to like fly these kites with fire on the kites against actual tanks that were lined up on the side. You know, so it's the David and Goliath story, but not the way that Israel will have you believe that it is. Israel is absolutely the Goliath in this situation. There's no question.
Take one more.
Thank you for your talk today.
Thanks.
And a couple of weeks ago, were you at a rally in front of the processing center in Indianapolis?
I was.
I thought so. Thank you. That particular rally gave me hope, because when you looked at the people there, and there were hundreds of people there, we were all shapes, sizes, religions, gender, race, culture. And it gave me hope that we're fighting together against hate. The thing, my question is, though, we meet, you know, in front of a processing center, mm-hmm. and then we go home. And Puerto Ricans showed us how to do this.
That's right.
And I don't know what we need to do to get people on the street. I know that there was a time last summer when I came out and protested by myself in front of the courthouse, and I was greeted by four trucks with guns that came out at me and told to F the children. Yeah. And then a group of ladies, strong ladies, came with me the next time, and we faced the same hatred. So the only way we're going to do this is together.
Yeah. I think you make so many great points. That rally also gave me some hope.
It was amazing.
There's a crack in the armor right now, right? The discourse is changing. I have been in Palestinian liberation work for many years, and the conversations that we're having today in the spaces that we're having them, that they're coming down from congresswomen and from kids in high school and just all the places that this stuff would never have been talked about. And all of a sudden, it's on people's tongues. It's in the language. People are questioning and seeing connections to different events, connections between what happened in Ferguson and what's happening in Palestine and what's happening at the border in the U.S. and what happened in Nazi Germany and the Holocaust, that these are all related to each other. And I think, like you said, we are stronger together. We are stronger when we are stand in solidarity, and we are the strongest when we're listening to the voices of those amongst us who are the most marginalized, who are saying, this is what we need, this is what the call to action looks like, this is what you can do for me as a person who's white, who has white privilege, who is relatively safe. Here's where I need you to stand, here's where I need you to put your body and use your voice. And the more that we listen to those voices and that we take seriously what is being asked of us as, and I like to use the word accomplice rather than ally, as someone who's genuinely in this, I think you're right that we can resist this, that this is not futile. And you read the news and you turn on Facebook and you start to feel a little bit overwhelmed, and then you sit in a room like this tonight and you talk to a group of people who have chosen to spend a Sunday night thinking about justice and thinking about what they can do and what we can do tomorrow to make things better for everyone here in our country and in our world. So I agree. I don't think hope is lost. I do think it is going to ask more of us than we have, many of us have seen in our lifetime. Those who were part of the anti-war movement, I think Vietnam, have a closer idea to what will be asked of us, but it's coming for us, and direct action, I believe, in civility or a different version of civility is going to be necessary.
2020.
That's
right.
Just out of curiosity, how many people know there's a concentration camp in Indianapolis? Raise your hand if you. That's it.
Yeah, it's an ICE processing center.
There's a processing center. It used to be the detention center, but they've moved so many that they now have a camp, a building separate from that now. It's in an industrial area.
Yes.
People don't realize it's there. So we need to educate ourselves.
Knowledge is power.
Well, I'd like to thank you very much for speaking tonight, and hopefully you can stick around for a little while downstairs
yeah.
with us.
Yeah.
All right, and carry on the conversation downstairs. Bill?
Sure. Thank you, Malcolm.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you.